Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this workshop for the invitation. It's always a great pleasure to come to such a beautiful spot here and to have somehow some free time, so to say, to work on physics without being bothered by students and problem with the spectrometer, so I don't know what. Anyhow, it's really a great pleasure to be here, and I would like to briefly review some selected results on so-called optical properties of correlated systems. As a logo for this presentation, I choose the one which we proposed for a conference we organized a few years ago in Zurich on strongly correlated electron system. So in Switzerland, we don't have beautiful beaches and the sea, but we have beautiful mountains. So we were thinking to two-person doing downhill ski from the mountain as two correlated electrons, so to say. Okay, let me start with the motivation. Why optics and what for? Well, I think that in the past few years, optics was really a powerful experimental tool in order to address a variety of topics and issues. Some of them are mentioned here. It's just a partial list with a few key words. In order to get information on the intrinsic physical properties of a variety of materials. This is, as I said, a partial list which mainly address those topics on which we were working in the recent past or on which we are still performing our research program, so to say. It's hopeless today, in 45 minutes or so, to address all these topics on which we were working. So I made a choice. I will select two topics. I will first of all try to briefly mention what is the electrodynamic response of condom materials, particularly heavy electron system, as first example of strongly correlated electron system in order to show you how optics is affected by correlation effect in that specific area. And then in the second part of my talk, I will try to focus my attention on so-called low-dimensional system. Particularly, I would like to address from the perspective of the optical point of view how the dimensionality of the interacting electron gas affect the optical properties and consequently the intrinsic physical properties of a variety of quasi-1D system. And I will try not only to show data, but also eventually, hopefully, to give a short explanation for them, but also to mention open questions, which I think are still a puzzling aspect in this area and which probably are of interest, particularly for a theorist. Let me, first of all, try to mention how the experiment is done, just for those who are not so familiar in optical techniques, in order to introduce some of the quantities I'm going to discuss later on. So I will present data as the real part of the optical conductivity, and experimentally, this can be done by measuring, first of all, the optical reflectivity, which is the magnitude of the complex reflectance. We can measure this quantity with a combination of several spectrometers over a very broad frequency spectral range, basically from the far infrared up to the UV, on a continuum of frequency as a function of temperature as well as magnetic field. We can also extend the measurable spectral range down to the microwave or submillimeter spectral range, even radio frequency spectral range, this with so-called cavity resonant techniques. This is done in collaboration with Professor George Kuhner here at UCLA. Now, when you know the optical reflectivity over a spectral range which extends over several decades or order of magnitude in photon energy, then you can perform reliable Kramers-Kronig transformation from where you get the phase of the complex reflectance. And as everybody knows from standard books about electrodynamics like Jackson, you can then calculate from there all optical functions, like, for instance, the real part, sigma 1, of the optical conductivity. So this is just a sketch of the expected relationship between the measured quantity and the real part of the optical conductivity for a metal and an insulator. First of all, for a metal, at some point, we expect a rise of the optical reflectivity, which can be razor sharp for very good metal. The reflectivity will then go towards total reflection, so 100% for frequency going towards zero. And this is a so-called plasma edge-like behavior of the optical reflectivity, the typical fingerprints for metal. And this leads to a zero energy mode in the real part of the optical conductivity, which for ordinary metal is actually the Drude resonance. And the DC limit of the optical conductivity, if things are done properly, should coincide with the DC value of the conductivity itself that you get from the transport results. Now, you can also consider the width of that, let's say, Drude resonance as a measurement of the scattering rate. You can also perform spectral weight arguments, so you can integrate the optical conductivity. And if you do the integral of that resonance at zero frequency, you get the spectral weight of the free charge carriers, which is actually proportional to the plasma frequency square, namely the ratio of the charge carrier concentration over the effective mass. For an insulator, the reflectivity will saturate to a constant value at low energy. This is a spectral range where the system is basically transparent with respect to electronic interband transition. So the first possible electronic excitation will coincide with the absorptions due to the insulating gap. Within the gap, you can see obviously other type of excitations, like phonon modes due to the lattice dynamics. And this because in an insulator, you don't have the free charge carriers, which otherwise would screen completely the system from the electromagnetic radiation, as it is the case basically in good metals. Now, so much for the experiment. Let me just mention that we are pretty well equipped with a variety of spectrometers in combination with various cryostats and so on in order to perform measurement, as I said, on a very broad spectral range, and also as a function of temperature and magnetic field. So I'm talking basically to an audience of distinguished theory, so I don't want to bother you with technicalities, but please refer to my webpage if you want to know more on our facilities. Okay, let me move to the first topic I would like to discuss today, and I would like just to flash on the expected electrodynamic response, on the measured electrodynamic response in condom materials and specifically in heavy electron systems. So I don't need here certainly to review the condo effect, which is the basic principle for the formation of heavy electrons. Let me just mention that in such system you have basically localized F electrons, we say well-localized magnetic moment, and the extended state of the conduction band will try to screen out that localized magnetic moment, so there will be the formation of a so-called condo clouds around the magnetic moment of the F electrons, and this is basically the consequence of a so-called hybridization effect. It turns out that electrons very close to the Fermi energy are the are energetically suitable in order to perform such a screening, and this leads to the formation of a narrow resonance, the so-called Abrikosov-Soul resonance, which, as I said, is very narrow. The width is of the order of the condo temperature, and electrons, or let's say quasi-particles, I must say, sitting in that narrow resonance will be characterized by a large density of state, or because of the curvature, by a very large effective mass. And indeed, the new heavy quasi-particles, as consequence of that hybridization between localized F state and the more extended state of the conduction bands, will be responsible for the transport magnetic thermodynamic properties of the system. And indeed, there are important consequences or important changes going from an ordinary metal to a so-called heavy electron system. This comparison is not universal in the sense that this behavior is not a universal one, but basically what you get, you might have a very strong suppression of the resistivity which follow at very small temperature at T square behavior. And also very important is that the T to zero limit of the magnetic susceptibility as well as of the specific heat is very much enhanced with respect to the corresponding values in ordinary metals. And this can be explained by still using the same, formalins, the Fermi liquid formally, so to say, but by assuming that those quantity are very strongly renormalized by correlation effect, and that renormalization is represented by the enhancement of the effective mass of the heavy quasi-particles. And so basically you can explain this enhancement by assuming that the itinerant charges, so to say, have a very large effective mass. And the optics is also very much affected by the formation of heavy electrons. And here I would like just to review what we did already a few years ago on a prototype heavy electron system, the cerium aluminum 3 compound. This work was done in Zurich and also partially at UCLA quite 10 years ago when I was here as a postdoc. But I think it's very representative of what we got in heavy electromaterials in general. So I'm showing you here the real part of the optical conductivity. I'm using a logarithmic energy scale. I know that the theorists are not so happy with this type of representation. In fact, once I was discussing some data with Maurice Rice in Zurich, not this one, and he told me the theorists do not like logarithmic energy scale because they can only think in linear scale. Anyhow, I'm forced to show you this in a logarithmic energy scale because I would like to show you, first of all, the full measured spectral range over several decades, and also because, as you are going to see, the effect, because of the formation of heavy quasi-particles, are very much associated with the low spectral range. So at temperature, which are larger than the condo temperature, you have a flat conductivity, which fall off at larger energy. This can be reproduced very nicely just by a Drude model. It's just a simple Drude behavior, nothing special. But then when you lower the temperature below the condo temperature, then you have here, you see in the very low spectral range, in the far infrared into the microwave spectral range, you have the formation of a narrow resonance, a zero energy mode indeed, and the DC limit of the optical conductivity tracks very nicely the behavior of the resistivity. Indeed, you can also see that this resonance progressively developed with decreasing temperature. And this resonance is really the fingerprints in the optical properties of heavy electron materials. We found this, and not only by ourselves, but also other groups, in other prototype so-called heavy electron materials that at low temperature, they always have this kind of very narrow resonance. So a piling up of spectral weight at very low energy and a very strong enhancement of the conductivity itself. Now this, yes?
Just to elaborate on your point that logarithmic scales are confusing, despite this plot, the spectral weight that is growing here is small, right?
This is the reason why I mentioned that, in fact, and not to be confused, because of the logarithmic energy scale, it artificially enhances the spectral weight, and this will be particularly important afterwards when I'm going to talk about low-dimensional system. Yeah, this is what exactly the reason why I mentioned that. So to pay attention on this issue, and then let me show you then the theoretical curve, but in linear scale. Well, there are several models which were, or several theory which were devoted to description of the optical properties and condo materials, heavy electron materials. Here I'm just quoting as example the work by Millis, Lee, and co-workers, because I think it represents somehow the general behavior in this compound. They work out basically the model within the Anderson lattice Hamiltonian by assuming localized air state, hybridizing with the more extended state of the conduction bands. And what they found indeed is what has been seen also experimentally, a very narrow zero energy mode, and then the conductivity, the optical conductivity, saturates to a constant value at larger energy. It turns out that this resonance can be very well reproduced by a so-called Drude-like resonance, but a renormalized Drude resonance, in the sense that the Drude model should be considering the two relevant parameters, the scattering rate and the plasma frequency, should be in fact renormalized by the correlation effect. The scattering rate is basically the width of that resonance, and it turns out that the enhancement of the relaxation time goes hand in hand with the enhancement of the effective mass of the heavy quasi-particle that you can extract from spectral weight argument. So basically you can integrate, as I mentioned before, that resonance, and then from there you can calculate back the effective mass, which turns out to be a factor of 100 and many compounds also up to 1,000 times larger than the effective mass in ordinary matter, than the free electron mass or the band mass, depending what are you defining indeed. So this just to mention that you can basically apply the same Drude model, so to say, but renormalized by correlation effect. And you can generalize this type of spectral weight argument, and you can do it generally for all materials. So basically what you can do, you can, from optical experiment, calculate, as I said, from the spectral weight, the effective mass for ordinary metal as well as for more correlated one, and plot this quantity versus another quantity which can be reached independently with another experiment, namely the gamma, the Sommerfeld gamma value of the specific heat. And you see that...
What is normalization for the mass here?
Well, this is just the effective mass, yes, with respect to the free electron mass. It's just the enhancement here, in fact. But for all of them, it was done in the same way. I mean, you always go to the corresponding. I mean, it depends whether you represent this as a function of the free electron mass or the band mass. But I mean, if you do it consistently, it comes out basically the same. And what you see that from this representation, that basically all these points fall more or less on the same line, experimentally, obviously. So you can basically say that the larger is the density of state at the Fermi level, the larger will be also the corresponding effective mass. And this somehow naively can be considered as the representation, the graphic representation for the realization of the quasi-particle concept, the basic concept of the Landau's Fermi liquid theory, namely that you can establish a one-to-one correspondence between the excitation of a free electron gas and those of an interacting electron system in various materials. And also, in the T to zero limit, this would mean that the specific heat as well as the magnetic susceptibility should saturate to a constant value, yet renormalized eventually by this correlation effect, and the resistivity can have this T-square behavior. And this was indeed found in most of these compounds. Also from optics, you can calculate and you can extract within a generalized Drude approach, which I'm not going to discuss today, the frequency and the temperature dependence of the scattering rate. And it turns out that for the great majority of those compounds here, you can get a square dependence, which once again is in accordance with the Fermi liquid predictions. However, there are...
that line is m proportional to gamma, right?
This m, yeah.
Because before you flashed the line on there, if I'd drawn a line through there by my eye, I would have had a different slope.
As I said, I mean, it's an experimentalist representation. So, I mean, anyhow, I mean, you know, these are different measurements done with different, I mean, these different techniques, optics on that side, specific heat on that side. And here I took what is expected, let's say, from the theory. And just to mention that indeed, I mean, more or less all the points, besides some deviations, so to say, follow more or less that that lines. Now that this you can go there and find all possible slope,
right.
But then I mean,
flatter slope would be a better least square fit.
Maybe. actually, I try once to fit, and this the real fitting curve is not really so much different from what you do so here. But I mean, we can discuss certainly. My point is just to mention that more or less this system. Follow that trend, so to say, okay? And there seems to be a kind of unified picture, and that basically here you can say that for ordinary metal as well as for more strongly correlated one, you can apply the same type of formalin, so to say. You have only to pay attention that some quantities will be renormalized, as I said, by the correlation effect, and you might represent this by the enhancement of the effective mass. But the idea here was to show that, or to say that these heavy electron materials are in general Fermi liquid-like, because there are other systems which in the late 90s raised quite a bit of interest, and which are some of them are listed here, so-called Kondo alloys, for which at low temperature there are important deviation from the Fermi liquid prediction. It was found indeed for these materials and many others that the resistivity, for instance, follow a linear temperature dependence, and then the specific heat as well as the magnetic susceptibility might have a logarithmically divergent behavior or a power law behavior. And for one of these compounds, you can see directly the experimental results. So I wanted just to mention this as one example of non-Fermi liquid materials on these Kondo alloys, because this system raised quite a bit of interest from the theoretical point of view. The non-Fermi liquid behavior was associated with a multi-channel Kondo model following the very first description by Nozier and Blandin. There was also suggestion that disorder, which is in fact important when you do alloying, could play an important role inducing a distribution of Kondo temperature. And it was shown that when the distribution for a Kondo temperature equal to zero is different from zero, you can get this type of non-Fermi liquid behavior, or the fact that this system might be close to a quantum critical point at T equals zero, And basically, what we do see as non-Fermi liquid behavior is due to a kind of fluctuation effect due to the proximity of this quantum critical point. So this just to mention that, I mean, there are other materials which deviates from the Fermi liquid picture. And I just wanted to mention this in order basically to introduce the second topic of my presentation, namely that non-Fermi liquid behavior can also occur when you reduce the dimensionality of the interacting electron gas. Already, high-temperature superconductors, which are truly two-dimensional systems, so to say, they are believed to be marginal Fermi liquid. So, and the marginality indeed was first discovered experimentally by optical experiment by Basov, Timusk, and Tanner. But also one-dimensional system. And indeed, when you confine electrons along a one-dimensional chain, so in 1D, then the Fermi liquid picture breaks down. You have the development of a new quantum state known as the Tomonaga-Luttinger liquid state. Here I try to sketch at t equals 0 the momentum distribution function. First of all, for an interacting electron gas, and there we have the well-known discontinuity at the Fermi wave actual Kf, which is indeed the renormalization factor. But when you reduce the dimensionality to 1, then you have a behavior of the momentum distribution function like that, namely this function smoothly goes through the Fermi wave actual. That discontinuity goes to 0. And this leads to a power law behavior in the density of state very close to the Fermi energy, and this is going to affect considerably various measurable quantity, particularly spectroscopic quantities, as I'm going to show you later on. Another consequence of this Tomonaga-Luttinger liquid state is also the breakdown of the quasi-particle concept, and also the so-called spin-charge separation, namely that the spin and the charge excitation can disperse with different velocity. And this is particularly relevant for those spectroscopists doing a photo emission or applying photo emission techniques where they can possibly follow in some particular condition these Ohlone and spin-on excitations in their spectrum. Now, there was a great deal of effort in the past few years to try to find materials, real materials, which approach the 1D limit, and the so-called organic Bethe gas salts were intensively studied in the past few 10 years, I would say, because of the issue I just briefly mentioned before. These are the very first organic superconductors, by the way, and they are characterized by a very anisotropic crystallographic structure consisting of one-dimensional chain where you have this stacking of this organic molecule. There are two types of molecule, the TMTSF and the TMTTF molecule, along this 1D chain. And these 1D units are held together in a three-dimensional structure by a variety of chemical groups or counter ions. And the photo pictures give you the possibility to appreciate the shape, the geometrical shape of the crystallites we measure optically, namely they are very elongated and needle-like crystals. Now, the interest in these materials is also because of the Rayser complex phase diagram. Here I'm showing you just a partial view of the diagram, temperature versus pressure. So at low temperature, upon the application of pressure, or in an equivalent way by changing the chemistry, so going from the TMTTF to the TMTSF compounds, you can scan a Rayser complex phase diagram, so you can go from a spin pulse to a spin density wave or to a superconducting state. On the ground state properties, there was already a lot of work done in the past. We also done a lot of work on the spin density wave ground state. I presented this already on several occasions. So today, I'm going to focus my attention on the so-called normal state properties because of this crossover between an insulating state, possibly due to charge localization, and the conducting phase, which might be eventually a bit anomalous because of the low dimensionality of the electronic structure. So let me show you first the temperature dependence of the resistivity measured along the 1D chain axis. And we see that for this Bethe gas salts based on the TMTSF molecule, you have a metallic behavior all the way down to low temperature of the order of 10 degrees or so, where you have the metal insulator phase transition because of the spin density wave phase transition, so the formation of a spin density wave condensate. For the Beshgar salts based on the TMTTF molecule, you have already a temperature of 100 degrees or higher, a metal insulator phase transition. So these two materials are already in an insulating state even before they undergo at much lower temperature a spin pulse or a spin density wave phase transition. So these four materials are, from the crystallographic point of view, totally equivalent, but they are perfectly the same, but they are characterized by different transport properties, and this initially triggered our attention and was somehow the motivation to look into the optical properties, which I would like here to summarize with a few selected curves. Some of you already know this spectra. So for the for this Beshgar source, based on the TMTTF molecule, for both of them, we found basically an insulating-like optical conductivity, in the sense that you don't have spectral wave whatsoever in that spectral range. So the system here is transparent indeed. And you do see a bunch of phonon modes and some electronic interband transition at larger energy. Later on, I'm going to show you that by comparing these results with other type of spectroscopies, we can also identify the position of the insulating gap. And the optical conductivity shown here is with light polarized along the chain axis. So I'm showing you exactly the electrodynamic response of the 1D chain. On the other end, for the TMTSF compounds, for both of them, we have the persistence of a very strong far infrared mode here. But then additionally, you do have spectral weight at low energy. You see here that you see here the onset of another excitation. If you follow that excitation at lower energy, you will see that it will merge into the DC value of the conductivity. This is, I just cut the figure here for the purpose of the representation, but this is a very robust result. We measured, in fact, not only with infrared spectroscopy, but down to low energy with resonant cavity technique. So indeed, this is the high frequency tail of a so-called zero energy mode in the optical conductivity and correspond to the effective metallic contribution in the optical properties. And what you can realize by yourself that this zero energy mode is very narrow. The width must be smaller, in fact, than milli electron volt. This is a very tiny quantity, which indeed is might be considered already as an indication that the free charge carriers involved in this effective metallic contribution are strongly correlated, somehow in a similar way as I did show you right at the beginning for the heavy fermion materials, where also you have a very narrow through the resonance, although the physics is completely different. And also, this zero energy mode, which is very narrow, also contain a very small amount of spectral wave. This is also the point Antoine was making before. Don't be confused by logarithmic energy scale. If you integrate that resonance, you get a tiny amount of spectral weight, which correspond to about 1 or 2% of the total spectral weight that you would obtain by integrating the optical conductivity all the way up to about 1 electron volt. So the great majority of the spectral weight is in this far infrared mode, and just a tiny amount in this narrow zero energy mode, which is, however, very important for the effective metallic behavior of this system, as seen from the transport properties. The least we can say that these spectra are not simple Drude-like. There are at least, in fact, two important contributions here. So these data were
temperature dependence of these features.
Yes, I don't have the figure with me, but by increasing the temperature in that case, you have a broadening of that features, which basically disappear at higher temperature, and then spectral weight piles up at much larger energy, so it moves up around there.
But is the integrated spectral weight temperature independent?
This remain constant, yes. Well, the total spectral weight always remain constant, but it's somehow redistributed differently.
And is there transfer spectral weight between the Drude feature and the mid-infrared?
Yes, I mean, this lower a bit and spectral weight goes over there, and then this comes down and is very broad then. And by lowering the temperature, you go from spectral weight here, which piles up partially here, and a tiny amount in this narrow resonance here. Because, as I said, this is really a very tiny amount. It's just, let's say, 1-2%. So anyhow, what do you distribute down there here? It's a very tiny quantity. The great action, so to say, occurs around here, where spectral weight moves up from, let's say, this spectral range into this resonance. But the spectral weight remained constant anyhow.
How anisotropic are these things in the optical conductor?
I'm sorry?
How anisotropic are these things in the optical
conductor? Yeah, in fact, it's about what I want to come now. Okay, so the spectral weight remained constant, but it's somehow redistributed in a different way. But you always have, let's say, in the optical spectra, I mean, here we show the temperature in the normal state close enough to the spin and city wave phase transition, but still above. You have a tiny amount here, and here the green majority over there. Now, I wanted to come indeed to the transverse direction. Here I'm showing you the reflectivity, so the measured quantities. There's no Kramers-Kronig transformation whatsoever involved in these things here. I'm just showing you the measured optical reflectivity with light polarized in the transverse direction, so between the chain. Okay, and then first of all, for the TMTSF compound, you have here a so-called overdamped-like optical reflectivity. The sharp lines here is just the phonon modes. We can forget this one for the present discussion. And then when you lower the temperature, then you see the formation of a very nice plasma edge-like behavior in the optical reflectivity, always in the transverse direction. So the reflectivity is very much enhanced, as you can see. This is an indication of a good metal. If you do the Kramers-Kronig transformation, so if you calculate the real part, for instance, of the optical conductivity, for that one you basically have a negligibly small contribution in the optical spectra, basically zero. It's quite an insulator in this overdamped-like regime. But because of this very nice plasma edge behavior in the optical reflectivity, then you will get a Drude component in the optical spectra at low temperature. So for this compound, by lowering the temperature, you go from an overdamped-like regime, basically you can say an insulating state, into a metallic state at low temperature. On the other end, for the other source, the one based on that molecule, so the TMTTF, we found at any temperature an overdamped-like behavior of the optical reflectivity, namely that spectra here remains temperature independent. So there's really an important difference between these two class of Beshkar soils. In the transverse direction, this one remains basically in a quite insulating state, but this one seems to cross over into a metallic state. And these results will be clear, hopefully, a little bit later. Let me also add something which we did more recently. We were also able to measure for these two compounds the optical reflectivity along the least conducting axis, which will be the less conducting one, I mean the C-axis in that geometry, and we found a very flat optical reflectivity, even more overdamped, which basically leads to absolutely no contribution whatsoever in the optical spectra. So basically along the third direction, the least conducting one, all of them are really in an insulating state. Besides eventually the ClO4 compound, where there seems to be a very tiny formation of Drude weight at low temperature, also in the C direction, but probably that system is already in a quite anisotropic three-dimensional state. Okay, let me mention that these optical results I just briefly sketched raised quite a bit of interest. We were pleased to see that so many theorists were trying to calculate and to address the optical conductivity in this 1D system. Some theorists even coined the expression of infrared puzzle in order to address the non-simple Drude-like behavior of the optical spectra I showed you before, and particularly the very tiny amount of a spectral weight encounter in this effective metallic contribution in the excitation spectrum. This is just a partial list, so I'm sorry if I'm missing here some relevant and important paper of persons in the audience, but this is certainly something in progress. I don't have neither the time nor the pretension to be able to go through all of them. Probably I'm not capable to do that, but I would like just to briefly flash on some original idea by Thierry Giammarchi, because I think that that model, also in some respect quite phenomenological, attaches the essential physics of this 1D system and also allows us a quite one-to-one comparison between the theoretical prediction and measured data. And the original idea by Thierry was to consider this system at the verge of a Mott-insulating state, roughly speaking. So if you consider, for the sake of simplicity, a so-called half-field band scenario, by turning on the interaction, you are going to split the conduction band in an upper and in a lower upper band. The lower one will be completely filled indeed. And so you introduce, because of correlation, a charge correlation gap or Mortimer gap, which is the only possible excitation in the system. And this should lead to a so-called square root singularity at the gap energy in the optical conductivity, and at a temperature of the order of the charge correlation gap, you should cross over into an activated behavior in the transport result. This is phenomenologically the scenario, so to say, for a one-dimensional MOT insulator. This is represented in a very naive way. Theoretically, it has been argued that if you start from a Luttinger Hamiltonian and you take into account the periodicity of the lattice, so basically if you take into account a so-called Umklapp scattering process, then a Luttinger liquid is unstable with respect to such Umklapp scattering process and crossover into a MOT insulator. Real materials, I mean the materials we are measuring anyhow, are an ensemble, so to say, of one-dimensional chain, and there's always an interaction between the chain, a so-called interchain coupling, which is represented by the transverse charge transfer integral, which give you the probability, so to say, of electrons to delocalize, to deconfine on parallel chain. And these parameters is very important. It can be enhanced in a variety of ways, experimentally, by applying pressure or by changing the chemistry, and basically effectively defines the intrinsic dimensionality of the system. And it has been argued
that the infrared feature in this cartoon.
I'm sorry?
Where would be the infrared feature in this cartoon?
I'm going to come back to that point in just a few minutes. It will be around here, but I'm going to come back. So let me just briefly go through some things here, because then I will need this for the comparison with experimental data. As I said, for a real system, you have the interchain coupling. And it has been argued that basically that interchain coupling produce deviation from the commensurability situation, so that you start to populate the upper band. And because of that partially filled upper band, you should introduce drew the weight in the optical conductivity, which theoretically is a delta function at frequency zero, and you should expect a metallic behavior all the way down to low temperature in the transport result. So because of that deviation from commensurability due to the interchain coupling, you have a situation which effectively looks like as a self-doping of the system. The correlation gap will progressively squeeze, but you can still excite across a pseudo gap, so you can still perform a pseudo gap excitation, and the theoretical prediction in that respect is a broader feature instead of a singularity. Before comparing the data with that scenario, let me just stress something which I will consider later, namely that the theory also predicts characteristic power laws behavior at a large enough energy scale. Large enough energy scale means in that context that you are at a photon energy or temperature which are larger than the interchain coupling or larger than the charge correlation gap. There you should recover the one-dimensional limit, because at that large energy scale, the system cannot recognize the warping of the Fermi surface due to the interchain coupling itself. So you should expect the Luttinger liquid behavior, for which the prediction tells us that you should expect a characteristic but non-universal power loss behavior, which all depends, however, from the same parameter, the K-rho Luttinger liquid parameter, which describes the strengths of interaction and the commensurability of the system, which is defined by the chemistry of the system. Now, let me mention that I think that that scenario, as far as optics, but also as the transport properties are concerned, catches the essential experimental findings I sketched before. Here I would like to record once again the optical conductivity. So for these soils, we can compare the optical conductivity with dielectric function measurement or with photoemission spectra, so we can identify very clearly the insulating gap. And then if the system are in an insulating state, as I mentioned before, this is an experimental fact. And then we would like to claim that that strong far infrared feature, this was your question before, that persists in that source is indeed basically the persistence of a correlation gap, which for those materials here is a kind of correlation pseudo gap. And this is also supported by spectral weight argument, because indeed the great majority of the expected spectral weight, considering from the chemistry, the total number of charges is encountered by that resonance. Additionally, in those compounds, we have spectral weight to low temperature, which, in our opinion, correspond experimentally to the the experimental counterpart of the narrow zero energy mode of this Drude weight, this delta function theoretically predicted by Thierry. And this, in fact, should correspond to the spectral weight of those charges which somehow are effectively doped in the system because of the interchain coupling.
Sorry, could yes? you remind me, I mean, if you introduce band curvature in the Latin liquid, I mean, then you also get some odd fill-in of these of the optical conductivity already. I mean, do you also get it through the peak, I mean, in that case, or?
You could have through the peak, yes. Yes, you could.
I see, so I mean, it's not necessary if you have this other picture.
Well, the problem is how then to explain that features here in that.
I think it still persists, even if you have band curvature, but anyway, we can talk about that.
Well, this is a possibility. I cannot exclude it. Yes?
So maybe I can make a remark on what you just said. I mean, this picture of self-doping is just a picture, really. In fact, the whole process is more driven by bandwidth control mode transition. And the system, right, and as we increase pressure on the TMTTF, it becomes closer and closer to the mode transition. But the chains stay at, well, at least we think, at 12 billion.
Yeah, I appreciate your...
Thierry introduced that as a sort of cartoon because he described the transition.
Yeah, this is the reason, you're totally right. And this is the reason why I said before, in some respect, as a phenomenological mean. So I wanted to stress that indeed, I know that this self-doping idea has only such a phenomenological meaning and is not really supported by strict theoretical consideration, but I think it catches anyhow somehow what is happening here. And because of that dimension...
But if you put pressure, if you squeeze, then what happens to the Drude peak?
Well, this is actually what happens. You don't have Drude peak here in the strictly 1D system. And then by applying pressure, which is equivalent in this system by just changing the chemistry, going from that molecule to that one, is exactly equivalent,
right.
Then you have the appearance of the Drude peak. Maybe an alternative representation will be this one, namely to show as a function of pressure, as I said, which in an equivalent way can be changed by changing the chemistry, going from that class of Peshkar salts, the so-called charge correlation gap, which we claim we have measured with optics, but is also confirmed by other set of data. And we see that that correlation gap progressively decreases with increasing pressure. And then this, this representation, I would like to claim, is the optical counterpart of the phase diagram that I showed you at the beginning. Let me compare those gaps with the so-called interchain coupling. And this is a bare quantity, and this is twice that quantity, so basically half the bandwidth.
Right.
In order to, yes.
Can you put in the same graph the intensity in the low energy to the peak as a function of pressure? Where would that be if I measure the area of the narrow Drude and if I plot it in this map?
Well, I have to reduce that because it's another quantity. It's not, but I would say, I mean, here you have a very tiny quantity, so it would go the other way around, actually. Here you have a very, actually zero. And then you would have some quantity. I mean, it would increase like that. Okay, so going from these to those compounds,
right.
Basically you have zero, but here I use a logarithmic
right.
energy scale, but you would have zero, and then you would go up.
Okay.
So you would increase it.
So it is consistent with the system, the canonical scenario of a system in a remote transition.
Yeah. Exactly, okay. Exactly. In fact, this is my point. Yep.
Even though it's not entirely clear from your experimental plot here, because the CLO4, I know there are two different temperatures, 10 and 20K.
Yeah.
But the CLO4 is corresponds to a higher pressure compound than PF6. Mm-hmm. And from these plots, I would say that the Drude weight in PF6 is bigger than CLO4, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, once again, this is just a plot that I cut it here because of the representation in order to make possible the view of that features, but the width is different. This is much narrower and goes up much higher than that one. So basically you have this situation. So the CLO4 looks narrow indeed. This is a CLO4. And the PF6 is also narrow, but something like that. So then, you know, this is narrow but much higher. So when you integrate, basically both of them are quite the same. Quite the same. Yes, but then by comparing the charge correlation gap with this interchain coupling, you can immediately see that there are somehow two regimes. There's on the left-hand side the situation which seems to be appropriate for those Peshkar souls, where the interchain the charge correlation gap is definitely much, much larger than the interchain coupling. So this is vanishingly small. It means that for electrons, it would cost, so to say, too much energy to delocalize on parallel chain. And because of that, they remain confined on a 1D chain. And this corresponds to the 1D mod insulating state, where, in fact, you don't have Drude weight whatsoever at low energy. On the other end, for those compounds here, you are in a situation where the interchain coupling is comparable or even larger than the charge correlation gap itself. So because of this, in quotation marks, self-doping effect, basically you start to delocalize, to deconfine electrons on parallel chain, so to say, and then this corresponds to a quasi-two-dimensional doped mod semiconductor. I mean, this was the expression coined by Thierry, that you can have in these materials, you can follow experimentally the crossover from a 1D mod insulator into a doped mod semiconductor, where the doping somehow is the consequence of the interchain coupling. So it's a dimensionality-driven insulator metal transition or crossover, I should say, dimensionality-driven, because by enhancing the interchain coupling, you somehow drive the system progressively away from the 1D scenario. Let me also point out eventually in a provocative way that the fact that we do see here a gap in the charge excitation spectrum, together with the fact that you don't have a gap in the spin sector of the excitation spectrum, could be considered also indirectly as an evidence for a spin charge separation. But as I said, it's somehow a provocative statement in this regard. There's also another aspect that I would like to stress, namely that you should recover at large enough energy this characteristic power loss behavior because of the Luttinger liquid state. Now here I'm showing you once again the same curve that I showed you before, just one example. I'm using right now a linear energy scale just to point out that indeed in this representation this zero narrow energy mode is really so narrow that it looks like as a spikes in this representation, so quite as a delta function. But as I said, it is a very robust result which was measured with different techniques. And obviously, in that linear scale representation, the grid feature is this so-called charge correlation, a pseudo gap for that compound. Now, the theory predicts that you should expect at large enough energy scale, and here the problem how large should be the energy scale is still very much debated indeed. You should expect anyhow a power law behavior. So what I would like to show you here is the same spectral range here, but now in a log-log representation, where the conductivity has been normalized by the maximum versus the energy normalized by the energy where the maximum occurs. And you see for different compounds a nice scaling, but particularly what interests me today is this power law behavior over quite one order of magnitude in photon energy. And this follow the theoretical prediction. This is an experimental fact. And you can also extract from that exponent the Luttinger liquid K rho parameter, which turns out to be much smaller than 1, 0.2, something like that, which indicates that correlation effect play an important role here. And it was found that that exponent is in agreement with what has been seen in other experiment. Photemation, although there's a big debate about the fact that the technique itself is very much surface sensitive. So I don't want to get into that point because I know that I would have too many questions on that. But still, I mean, there's an experimental result in the literature. We have to consider it. But we know that the state of the surface might affect considerably the interpretation of the data. anyhow, optics is a bulk-like technique, so we can go short for that. And anyhow, this results is in agreement with what has been done in Paris by Jerome and co-workers. They measured the temperature dependence of the resistivity along the chain and along the least conducting axis. They found two power law behaviors. I was told, but we have to discuss this more in detail, that as far as the least conducting axis, that theoretical interpretation might be questionable. I think that Antoine can tell us more about that. Anyhow, there are two power laws, and if we restrict our attention on the chain behavior, that power law here is consistent with the theoretical prediction and with the same Luttinger liquid K rho parameter we found in the optical spectra. So we have here indeed the following view on the phase diagram of this system. We can certainly claim, based on our experimental results and many other experimental evidences, that you have a kind of progressive crossover between a high energy scale Luttinger liquid behavior into a three-dimensional Fermi liquid behavior at low energy scale. In between, there's an intermediate phase for which Jerome coined the expression of incipient two-dimensional Fermi liquid, where you have basically the coexistence of both states. And this is very pertinent as far as the optical results are concerned, because with optics, you can have a snapshot of all energy scale at once. And indeed, I show you in the previous spectra, we found at large energy scale, this pseudo gap excitation, and particularly the power law behavior on the high energy tail of that pseudo gap excitation, which is consistent with the Luttinger liquid regime. But at low energy scale, we found these Drude weight, which is certainly representative of a Fermi liquid behavior, and this also in connection with the data in the transverse direction. I show you that for this compound, in fact, you have the appearance of a plasma edge behavior, so of a good metallic behavior in the optical reflectivity measured along the transverse direction, and this could be considered as an indication that by lowering the temperature in this compound, you have a progressive crossover from a 1D physics into a two-dimensional or eventually even a three-dimensional anisotropic Fermi liquid behavior, at least at low temperature or respectively at low energy scale. Now, the question now is what is next, what we would like to do in this respect, and I would like here in my last 5 minutes, if I still have 5 minutes, to flash on a few things which we are presently working on. Well, first of all, let me remind you the complete phase diagram of this quasi-1D system. And there's another important parameter, magnetic field. With magnetic field, you can counteract the action of pressure. So if with pressure, you increase the dimensionality of the system, with magnetic field, you can force electrons, so to say, along longitudinal trajectories with very little transverse dispersion. So you recover the 1D physics. And because of that, you have a cascade of field-induced spin-density wave phase transition. Now, we have, in the past few years, we have developed our spectroscopic tools in order to perform also magneto-optical investigation, namely investigation as a function of magnetic field. We would like to have a look on that from this perspective. But we think that the magnetic field is also very important in order to have an external variable in order to tune in a controlled way the dimensionality of the system, in order to follow how the system behaves when we leave the one-dimensional situation towards the two-dimensional state. And I think that even from the theoretical point of view, it's still very much debated what is going to happen when you increase the dimensionality from one to two, whether you can consider the two-dimensional system as an anisotropic Fermi liquid or as an ensemble of one-dimensional units more or less strongly correlated or interacting among each other. And I think that these are important problems, for instance, also in the perspective of the ITC superconductivity. But then we are also seeking other one-dimensional system, and we are looking to them from the optical point of view. So presently we are working, or we have been working on carbon nanotube and on the newly discovered molybdenum disulfide nanotubes. We have also done some work, and which is still in progress, on DNA, which are somehow prototype 1D system, or can be considered as the ultimate realization of a one-dimensional quantum wire. And here I would like to briefly flash some data we got recently on carbon nanotube, on the single-walled carbon nanotube. Well, it was shown here at Santa Barbara by a beautiful experiment that this 1D system must be indeed in a one-dimensional Luttinger liquid regime. They found a nice scaling of the a different temperature, in fact, of the conductance, which follow the power law behavior predicted by the Tomonaga Luttinger liquid state. So what we did was to measure optically such films, so-called Bucky papers, of single-walled carbon nanotubes. These are films with a dense random distribution of single-walled carbon nanotubes. Unfortunately, there's a technical problem in the sense that we cannot align all the tubules along a preferential direction. So this is, well, experimental, this is a serious problem, because if you want to do optics, we would like to do it as a function of polarization of light. So we lose the information about the anisotropy. However, you were laughing, but we aligned indeed single-wall carbon nanotube, but not carbon nanotube, not single-wall, but multi-wall carbon nanotube. There you can really do that, because and we did some previous work on multi-wall carbon nanotube, which grows basically perpendicular to a substrate, and then you can actually wrap this spacement like you were cleaning a carpet at home, exactly in the same way, and you can mechanically really, by rubbing this spacement with a thin aluminum foil, for instance, you can really align the tubules, but this can be done only for the multi-wall carbon nanotube, because this is the way they are produced. So here you cannot do that, so we lose the information about the anisotropy, but we can dope this system. It has been shown that by alkaline doping, you can enhance the metallicity of the system. So basically a chemical doping here more or less try to mimic the situation in Beskar salts upon the application of pressure, so to say. So we go from a pristine compound into a potassium intercalated system where you have the appearance in the magnetosusceptibility of a Pauli-like contribution, and also the transport results. You see you go from an insulating behavior in the pristine compound into a quite metallic behavior in the calcium-doped compound. And let me show you the optics. I would like to focus my attention only on the infrared spectral range. So even for the pristine compound, you have here a razor broad blue the light background. There's a spectral way down to low energy. But what is amazing is this very strong far infrared absorptions, quite in coincidence, at the same energy, I would say. This might be somehow embarrassing, but it's like that, as in the Beskar salts. It's a very broad features. Initially, we were saying, okay, this might be a convolution of phonon modes. But if you look the phonon spectrum for the graphite-like compound, you should expect phonon modes distributed over a much broader spectral range. So we don't think that these are due to phonon mode. And then when you do the same experiment as a function of doping, you have a piling up of spectral weight at low energy. So you have an overall enhancement of that overall Drude contribution at low energy, and that enhancement follow the DC properties, and you still have overlap to this Drude behavior, that strong far infrared mode in the optical spectrum. And we would like to claim that we have here a quite striking similarity with the situation we have seen in the Beskar salts. We have Drude weight and then these far infrared absorptions, which we would like to claim to be associated with a kind of charge correlation gap. So this system might be also at the verge of a mod insulating state. Now, we also measure, obviously, all the way up to larger energy. I'm not going to discuss this. You can see then some interband transition, but this is not the topic of today's presentation. Now, as I said, there are a few problems, a technical problem, due to the fact that you cannot align the tubules along a preferential direction. And then another maybe ill-defined problem for this system is that you cannot define the spacement uniquely from the electronic point of view. It means that you have a random distribution of any possible electronic state, because depending how you roll up the graphite sheet, so basically depending from the chirality of the tubules, you can tune the electronic properties from an insulating to a semi-metallic and metallic state. And in this kind of spacement, you have always have a kind of random distribution of all these electronic properties, even though the films we were looking at, they were characterized by chiralities, which were, for the great majority, in the metallic phase. And in this respect, very promising are the newly discovered molybdenum disulfide nanotube, because for that system, you can have spacemans which are uniquely characterized as far as the electronic properties are concerned. So you can produce spacemans where the tubules are all of the same chirality. And in fact, we are working on them, because this could be a very nice alternative to carbon nanotubes. This we probably refine a little bit also the analysis of the data, because we would like, in fact, to have a more precise information on possible power loss behavior, which at the present stage cannot be done seriously because of this distribution in the electronic properties of the
space. Sample, do you have ropes of tubes?
I'm sorry?
Are these individual single-mole nanotubes clumped together to make ropes?
Yeah, they are in ropes. Okay, so let me conclude. So I hope that with my presentation, I was able to give you an overview of some selected results on some example, indeed, of correlated system. I think that with optics, you can address all energy scales characterizing the absorption spectrum of a variety of compounds. You can also extract several parameters which can be related to the intrinsic physical properties of these systems. And as I said, you have access to all possible excitations. Now, what we are presently doing, I mean, the main focus now, the main effort experimentally, is to try to make this kind of measurements, but by using also another external variable, not only temperature, but also magnetic field, because as I said before, we hope that from the magneto-optical point of view, you can tune this system, this low-dimensional system, through different correlated states by tuning a controlled way also the dimensionality, the intrinsic dimensionality of the electronic properties of these materials. And this is what we are presently doing, and we hope to have some results soon. Okay, let me acknowledge the great work of my collaborators. I would like to mention my PhD student, my postdoc, some technical help of technicians of our institute, and particularly as far as the data I presented today are concerned, I would like to mention Verena Vescoli and my postdoc, Barbara Rudziska, and my first graduate student, Frank Bermelli. Okay, thank you very much for your kind attention. We are now working on these hexaborides materials, mm-hmm. and I can show you some data maybe privately. But what we found is that, for instance, in these hexaboride materials like European hexaboride, which is characterized by a very large magneto resistance, actually a colossal magneto resistance, we also found in connection with that a really huge blue shift of the plasma frequency in connection with the ferromagnetic phase transition. And what is particularly amazing is that we found a scaling between the Drude weight, which changed dramatically at the ferromagnetic phase transition, and the magnetization itself, which we cannot really explain right now. So this is something on which we are presently working as far as this magnetic system are concerned. Yeah.
Let's come back to your power laws. You said you have to go to frequencies which are larger than the transverse hopping, but then power laws are usually an asymptotic low energy feature. So on a way, you have to also know you have just an energy window where you hope to expect to see it. Well, do you have some feeling what these upper energy scales?
Yeah, I mean, what we did, you are right. In fact, I somehow mentioned this in my talk. The question is always how large should be that energy, or where you should look for that. Because when you have experimental spectra, I mean, let's assume that this is, in fact, this charge correlation gap features, right? But then you have a larger energy, other type of absorptions due to the interband transition. Now, we would like to, by analyzing our data, we wanted absolutely to avoid any artificial, handling of the data. For instance, what people do very often is to subtract artificially these features. And if you do it mathematically from the total spectrum, you can get basically whatever you want, because the low frequency tail of this feature will affect it. So what we did was just simply, we took the data in that spectral range, and we plug them in a log-log plot, and we look for any power loss. And we found that there, on the high frequency tail of what is, for us, the manifestation of the charge correlation gap, we found that. But without any artificial handling, so to say, or elaboration of the data itself. Obviously, as I mentioned, the problem is enough to look in that, or let's say, this spectral range where we claim we find this power law can be considered as the high frequency limit satisfying these conditions that you should be much larger than the interchain coupling and the charge correlation gap itself. I mean, we would like to say yes, but if you go much, much larger in energy to look eventually for an extension of that power law, then you go into that problem where you have to artificially subtract interband transition, and there, I mean, it's hopeless to do that. So you might be aware of this work by Zvelik and co-workers. They calculate optical conductivity. They also find a power loss behavior, but they were saying that this should appear at much larger energy. So it's somehow quite a coincidence that this remains, so to say, even to this spectral range, which is certainly higher, but still closer to the charge correlation gap, which is somehow down there.
Yeah. Maybe just to comment on energy scales. So as I understand in these systems, hopping along the chains on the scale of a quartile of an EV, while the hopping along the B direction is about 10 times smaller. So this gives you about a decay over which you can do that.
Obviously, in this, when we are talking about dimensionality, I would like to complement a bit your comments. And when we are looking to the spectrum, not only along the chain, but also in the transverse direction, then we have this dimensionality crossover. The problem, however, that experimentally, even in the transport properties, it seems that this occurs at temperature of the order of 100 degree, which energetically is somehow right about 100 wave numbers. But theoretically, you should describe everything in terms of an effective interchain coupling, which is a much smaller energy scale, so the order of 30 or even lower degree. So now the open question is still, where you should define that crossover and which one is the relevant energy scale, the one that you see experimentally, where you have also the maximum in the resistivity, or the one predicted theoretically. So this is also a still
well, probably the only solid evidence of 1D, maybe not in general, behavior in the system is from your experiment, from optics. Because the resistivity, as you just say, is in the range of a few, at most 300 K, and in that range, I don't think it's reasonable to think that these systems are really one.
When you found this transition from metallic to insulated, do you find some flux distortion?
No, we haven't seen any. We have looked somehow if phonon modes were somehow disturbed by the transition, but we didn't find any specific or systematic change in the phonon spectrum. No. But there's, however, a difference between the two class of materials concerning the dimerization gap. They are somehow dimerized, this system, and those which are based on the TMTTF molecules, so those on the insulating side of the phase diagram, they are more strongly dimerized than the other one. And in fact, those are really in a so-called R-field band scenario, because chemically, from the chemical point of view, this system are quarter-field system.
And it's not quite metallic, right? I
mean, no, so those one are insulating, yeah. Yeah.
Could you do this quarter-field?
Well, it was tried to dope them, I mean, chemically. The problem is that from the chemical point of view, it's very hard to perform the doping, in the sense that the crystal you get, they are not homogeneous. So the doping is somehow not of a very good quality. So then you have samples which are not so very good characterized. So doping in the sense of putting something or making a mixture of two compounds is actually not feasible because the quality of the crystal is not good.
Well, in the nanotubes, the alkali really dope the system. Sorry.
Oh, okay, yes. Yeah. I was talking about the Bech vessel, but for the nanotubes, yes, yeah, we did the doping, yes. Because it was the only way to change somehow the metallicity of the system, since you cannot control really the chirality of the single tubules. Yeah.